Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you're the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hey, Jen. How are you?
Camille. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. We look at us just barreling through these episodes, right?
I know. This is the ninth day, isn't it?
I do believe it is the ninth. Hold on. Yes.
Holy cow.
It's too many.
It's hard to count. I understand.
It is. So you getting excited about Christmas coming?
Not really.
Okay.
Not really.
And there we go. Okay. You ready to hear this one? This is a what the heck are people thinking kind of episode, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You ready? Ready to dive in?
Yep.
Here we go. This takes us back a little bit. This is a little bit older case. Not really old, but a little old. But a long, long tale, nonetheless. You ready?
It's a long tale. Yep. I'm ready.
Yep. On August 6, 1966, that's about the year you were born, right, Jen?
1866, but you're close. Okay. Yeah.
Kenneth McDuff and Roy Dale Green spent the day working for Kenneth's dad pouring concrete. When they finished for the day, they decided to go out and drive around, you know, kind of hang out, and, quote, look for a girl, end quote.
Oh, nice.
Sadly, they would come upon three teens and commit an unthinkable act.
I bet you it's murder, since it's going to be on a true crime podcast. I bet you it's murder.
It is, Jen. It's almost... God. Woo, you know ding, what? Ding, like ding, ding, like ding. Laura Power said, you're psychic a little bit. Just a
I
little.
Do.
Just
I do.
A little. Yep.
I've got the shining.
You got a,
it's the shining.
A little touched. You got the gift.
Mm-hmm. I'm very touched in the head, but I got the shining.
At 10 p.m. that same night, 17-year-old Robert Brand, 16-year-old Edna Louise Sullivan, who happened to be Robert's girlfriend, and Robert's 15-year-old cousin, Mark Dunham, were hanging out in Everton, Texas. You know, they're hanging out at a baseball field, just kind of doing what teens do, right? They just kind of hang out, honestly. They can't go to bars, mm-hmm. whatever.
They could be like us and hang outside of car washes and ask people to buy liquor for them.
I am so impressed. Jennifer, you are psychic because you're not going to believe what happens here. I swear to goodness, you're really not.
Oh, really?
Hold on. That's freaky psychic. Okay, so stay with me.
Look at me go.
Kenneth McDuff noticed Edna Sullivan, and in his sick, demented way, he decided he needed her. He pulls up alongside the teens, pulls out his .38 Colt revolver, and ordered them all to get in the trunk of their car. So they get into the truck of Robert's car, okay? Roy Green...
That's not good.
Yeah, you know what's going to happen. Roy Green is instructed to drive Kenneth McDuff's car, and following behind him would be Kenneth McDuff, and he's driving the victim's car. McDuff stops the car and orders Edna out of the trunk. He told Roy Green to put her into the trunk of his own car, which happened to be a Dodge Coronet. After this, Kenneth McDuff proceeded to fire six shots into the trunk of the victim's car. Now, this was Robert's car, and his young cousin Mark was still in the back of the trunk. He later claimed that he had told Roy, well, we have to do it.
We have to do it.
Yes. Kenneth McDuff and Roy Green then drive away from that crime scene, and they go to yet another location where both McDuff and Green rape Edna. McDuff then asks for something to strangle her with, and Green gives him his belt. But McDuff decides to go a different route, and he uses a broken broomstick handle instead. These first three murders would become known as the broomstick murders. They then dump her body in some bushes and take off. You with me? Have you heard of the broomstick murders?
I have, yeah, but it's horrifying, as we all know, but yeah.
Kenneth McDuff would later bury the revolver beside Roy Green's garage, and they went to go visit a mutual acquaintance, and his name was Richard Boyd. And Richard Boyd allowed McDuff to wash his car at his house. Now, I don't know about you, Jen, but if I was a thieving, no good person such as McDuff, and you came to my house, or I came to your house and asked you if I could wash my car, wouldn't you think, something's amiss, right?
Yeah, probably.
Maybe.
Most likely, yeah.
Buckling under the pressure, Roy Green confessed to their friend Richard's parents. He had ended up telling Green's mother, who then convinced him, Roy, to turn himself in. Roy Dale Green would serve 11 years, while McDuff received 3 death sentences, and eventually got to go sit in the electric chair in the sweet state of Texas for his part in the death of these 3 teens. This is where you're supposed to say, is that the end of the story?
Oh, sorry. I was waiting for you to go on. It's hard for me because I don't want to speak over you.
I got you.
Okay, so
that's
is
okay.
That the end of the story?
No, Jen, it's not. Thank you for asking. Even though this would be...
You are welcome.
You are welcome. Even though this would be McDuff's first murder conviction, he was not new to the life of crime. So let's go back a little bit. Let's just go back a little bit. In 1964, so this was 2 years prior to him committing these terrible acts, he was only 18 years old, and Kenneth McDuff was convicted of 12 counts of burglary and attempted burglary in Texas and was sentenced to 12 four-year prison terms. Now, that's math, Jen. 12 four-year prison terms. But these were to be served concurrently. Now, he made parole in December 1965. Now, this parole allowed him to go on to commit the violent crime spree that started the podcast at the top, right, with the 3 murders of the teens. But because this is the 12 days of murderous Christmas, 12 nightmares before Christmas, we know there's more to come, right?
We do know there's more to come.
But do you see the problem here? Like, he was in prison and let go, okay? But then with the 3 murders that he committed, he got the death sentence, right? So he should never be coming out. So the story should end right there, right?
You would think. Mm-hmm.
Oh, Jen, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. Although McDuff was sentenced to death, the sentence was overturned when the U.S. Supreme Court abolished capital punishment in 1972. He would now be serving life with the possibility of parole, which baffles me because he killed 3 teenagers, but okay. McDuff, with a bit more freedom and not as restricted as he was on death row, he decides to hire a lawyer. And, of course, he claims he's innocent and that Roy Green, he's the one that did it all. He was responsible for those teen murders, right?
Right.
The evidence that the attorney had collected was so good, in fact, that the parole board took note and said, you know, maybe it is possible. Maybe Roy Green actually did do all this. Now, McDuff, instead of just being happy that he impressed the parole board with all this evidence and stuff that the attorney was able to dig up, now we know he's a criminal and he's had a long history, right? So he decides to bribe a parole board member in exchange for a yes on parole, right? I'm going to bribe you, I'm going to give you some money, and you're going to let me go. The parole board member, of course, was not too happy about that, and McDuff would be given a 2-year sentence for that, for trying to bribe the official.
Well, at least the official didn't, like, accept the bribe, right?
Yeah, I mean, he turned him in, so he got additional time on there.
Yeah.
But fear not, Jen. Again, you'd think the story would be over now, but it's not.
No.
The board still believed that McDuff could contribute to society, and the Texas prisons were so overcrowded at that time that they decided to go ahead and grant him parole. He was released.
Oh.
Thank you. He had a death sentence, and now he's paroled. In 1989, he was released. Kenneth McDuff would turn out to be one of 20 former death row inmates and 127 murderers that would be paroled in the sweet state of Texas. Texas, okay?
And Texas loves to kill people. Well, prisoners.
I swear to God, you are so psychic. This comes up again later. Just wait.
Oh, really?
Like, you are nailing it, girl. You're nailing it. After he was out, McDuff got a job at a gas station. He was making like $4 an hour. And, you know, he's trying to better himself because, you know, he was on death row and now he's a free man. He starts taking classes at Texas State Technical College. And that's located in Waco, Texas. And we all know about Waco, Texas, right, Jen? What happened there?
Yeah. The big Branch Davidians.
That is correct.
There's a lot of things that happened, but the Branch Davidians is the one
that's the big one.
Remember.
That's the big one. By July 1990, he was arrested for the misdemeanor offense of making a terrorist threat. He had threatened a black lady. Apparently, he had made some negative, really gross racist slurs. And since this was a violation of his parole, bam, he goes back in the slammer.
Good.
Yeah, you'd think, right? But then the charges mm-hmm. would eventually be dropped. It seems witnesses were reluctant to testify. They had actually hoped that the parole board would revisit his criminal history, his criminal conduct, and revoke his parole and keep him in prison, which is where he belonged, of course, right?
Of course.
The board still paroling prisoners far too early because they were overcrowded, made an administrative decision. The board did not seek a revocation of his parole based on that terrible slur and threat he made against that poor woman, and simply released McDuff.
Hmm.
On December 6th, 1990, McDuff was free again.
Well, good. Isn't McDuff the crime-solving dog?
Well, I think it's funny that you say that because there is, I swear to God, there's a McDuff in Macbeth. And so every time I'm reading this, I'm thinking about this, right? Like McDuff, Macbeth. But isn't it's McGruff. McGruff is the crime solving dog.
McGruff. Take a, yeah. Now, there's a McDuff dog series about a Westie, but every time you say McDuff, I think about take a bite out of crime.
Right?
Yeah.
That's good stuff. All right. As McDuff was free at this point, okay? Now, Jen, it's important to add here that on October 14th, 1989, 31-year-old Serafina Parker's lifeless body was discovered along the I-35 corridor freeway in Temple, Texas. McDuff was in the area at this time, but he wasn't charged with the crime. It was only after all of this came out that the authorities believed that he was responsible for her murder. After learning all this, they also stated that they believed that Kenneth McDuff started killing only 3 days after being released on parole.
Three days.
10 months after McDuff's release on October 10th, 1991, Kenneth McDuff picked up a drug-addicted sex worker named Brenda Thompson. He tied her up and was holding her captive in his car, but noticed a police checkpoint and he freaked out. He stopped the car approximately 150 feet before reaching the actual police checkpoint. He stopped the car because he just kind of wanted to figure out what to do with her. Now, Brenda, little smarty pants, love her. She saw that this was happening, so she started kicking at the windshield of his truck. And she's actually cracking it as she's kicking it with her feet.
Good.
She's screaming, you know, save me, help me, whatever.
Fight, girl.
You go, girl.
Fight.
You go,
fight
her.
Hard.
Angry and afraid of getting caught, all this did was infuriate McDuff. He gunned the gas pedal and began to drive directly into officers. The police luckily jumped out of the way, and they reached their cruisers and began to chase him. He, however, escaped. He started going down one-way streets the wrong way. He turned out his lights. He was parking in random spots, you know, to lose them, and he did end up losing them. After losing them, he took off with her, found in wooded area near U.S. Route. I say route. Do you say route or route? Whatever.
It's Route 66, so I always say route.
Okay.
Get your kicks on Route 66.
Or route. It's one of those words. U.S. Route 84. It is here that he tortured Brenda Thompson to death. Her body was not discovered until 1998. That's 7 years later.
Oh my gosh.
He kept a lot of the stuff to himself, little sicko, and he did it on purpose. You know he did.
Of course he did.
And how fast he went. Ooh, infuriating. So, Jen, only 5 days later, on October 15th, 1991, Kenneth McDuff would be seen arguing with a 17-year-old sex worker by the name of Regina Deanne Moore at a Waco hotel. They were then last seen getting into his truck and leaving. Now, it would be determined later that McDuff drove to the Texas State Highway 6, found a desolate area. He would bind her arms and legs with stockings and then kill the young girl. Her body would not be discovered until September 29th, 1998. Again, years later. I don't understand that.
That poor family.
It must be really desolate areas down there.
You would think so. But, could you imagine just your kid goes missing and you don't find them? And
for all those years. And then, I don't know, like out of nowhere, somebody knocks on the door. How horrible is that?
Yeah.
On December 29th, 1991, Kenneth McDuff, along with Alva Hank Worley, would come upon Colleen Reed at a car wash. See, you mentioned that earlier. In Austin.
Working at the car washer.
Where they would abduct her in front of witnesses and then drive away only to rape and murder her. So they went to a car wash, saw Colleen, and took her. All these people standing by and witnesses. They left witnesses behind. In April 1992, Worley admitted to the Bell County Sheriff's Department. He was pulled in for questioning, and he admitted that he did rape Reed. And, you know, he did burn her with lit cigarettes, but he did not murder her.
Oh, okay.
Okay, right? Okay. You're a nice guy. After these murders were discovered, police also believed that McDuff murdered a 23-year-old named Cynthia Renee Gonzalez, who was found dead in a creek bed near County Road 313, I don't know how they say it in those parts, in a heavily wooded terrain area located about a mile west of the I-35 on September 21st, 1991. Now, this was 6 days after she was reported missing from Arlington. They piece all this together later, and this guy is mum. He's not going to... He took a lot of this to the grave with him. He really did. I'm still going. February 24th, 1992, a sex worker named Valencia Joshua was last seen knocking on the front door of a man by the name of Kenneth McDuff. Her strangled body would be discovered on March 15th at a golf course nearby. He's out of control.
A bit, yeah. I bet you they're regretting letting him out of prison on parole so early.
And thank you. We'll get to that in a minute, Jen. Kenneth McDuff's next victim would be a pregnant 22-year-old Waco Quick Pack convenience store clerk who was named Melissa Northrup. Now, this would be, incidentally, the same store that McDuff had worked in once he got released. Remember, he went and worked at that gas station, made like $4 an hour. This is the same store. But this would also be the crime that would finally bring justice. On March 1st, 1992, Kenneth McDuff kidnapped and later killed Melissa Northrup from the store, and he also took $250 cash from the cash register. Seriously. McDuff became a suspect early on because he was identified as being in the area at the time of her disappearance. Oh, as well as the fact that a friend of McDuff's told police officers that he had attempted to enlist him in helping rob the store.
Well, good. So now he stole a girl and $250.
And money, yeah. This crime would also land McDuff on America's Most Wanted. You know that TV show that we like, love? I don't even think it's on anymore, is
John
it?
Walsh.
It did wonders, though. Yeah, John Walsh. And it, because of this, he would become the object of a large, I mean, we're talking huge manhunt.
Good.
Melissa's body would be discovered by a fisherman, and her body was found on April 26th. Now, the investigation was difficult in that all of his victims, he was an idiot, but he was smart in the sense that he killed them in several different Texas counties, thereby making it harder for all the authorities to coordinate, right? So a little bit here, a little bit there. Like he was all over the place. Austin, Waco, was it Tempo? I forget the name, but all over the place. So it was hard to get one person to oversee all of it, right? One county to oversee all of it. But thank goodness, they're going to get some help. In April 1992, Bell County investigators brought in this guy, Mr. Worley, for some questioning. Basically, they only brought him in because they knew that he was a friend or acquaintance of Kenneth McDuff. Now, their socks were blown off because Worley not only told them things that they wanted to hear, but he admitted that he was involved in the kidnapping of Colleen Reed, and that's what they did earlier together. He was being held at the Travis County Jail, and during this time, him put away, they continued to look for Kenneth McDuff. But they knew now. They had confirmation that he had done this murder as well as all the others that they had started to suspect him of, right?
Right.
Shortly after the Worley questioning, they found Richard Fowler. You know Rich Fowler? Now, Rich Fowler, you know him. Good old guy. He's working as a trash collector in Kansas City, Missouri. And you know...
Rich.
Rich, right? Rich had a coworker who was a huge fan of what? America's Most Wanted, the TV show. And he noticed how much his buddy Rich Fowler looked like that guy that they were looking for named Kenneth McDuff. The coworker went to work and he was kind of having these feelings and he talked to one of his coworkers and they're like,
romantic feelings? Romantic feelings about Rich?
No, not that kind. He went and talked to a coworker and the coworker's like, hey, if you suspect this, you need to call. So he did. He called the Kansas City Police Department and he said, you know, this fella I work with by the name of Richard Fowler, he looks an awful lot like that McDuff fella. And so they thought, okay, you know, it's a tip. They get millions of them, of course, especially after a TV show like that. So the police department searched the name Richard Fowler from Kansas City. And guess what? They found out that Rich Fowler, he really liked sex workers. He liked them so much that he had been arrested for soliciting them. And you know what? Wouldn't you know it? Richard Fowler was, in fact, Kenneth or Killer McDuff. That was him.
Kenneth
McDuff had been using the name Rich Fowler.
So he was shocked.
Right? Texas to Missouri. Kenneth McDuff was indicted on one count of capital murder for Melissa Northrup's murder in McLennan County, Texas, on June 26th, 1992. Shocker, he was found guilty. In Texas, now, juries determine whether or not an individual convicted of a capital murder receives life imprisonment or the death penalty. On February 18th, 1993, the jury, in a special punishment hearing, opted to sentence Kenneth McDuff to death. He would spend 6 years on death row before finally being executed. Following a number of delays while appeals were being heard, I just watched the show last night, Jen, and I didn't quite realize this. I guess there's 16 levels, 16 appeals, if you want to use them all before they're exhausted, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of what city. Oh, it was in Indiana. It was Indiana's state pen. So it's 16 there, so I'm assuming it's 16 everywhere. If I'm wrong, let me know, people. I don't know. But I was like, wow, because not all of them use it, you know? But anyway, if you use them all, it's 16, which can go on for years. Back to the story. Following a number of delays while the appeals were being heard, the Western District Court denied habeas corpus relief and rescheduled the execution date for November 17th, 1998. As he was denied authorization for another appeal, he gave up Reed. That's how he ended up, the other girl he married. He gave up the burial location, and that was just a few weeks prior to being executed. I'm sure he was hoping that would buy him some time.
Right. I'm sure he was, too. It wasn't out of the niceness of
his
cold black heart. Yeah.
Nope. Kenneth McDuff is buried in the Captain Joe Byrd Cemetery, which is also known as Peckerwood Hill, and that's located in Huntsville, Texas. Prisoners buried there are those whose family chose not to claim the remains. His headstone contains only the date of his execution, which is 11/17/98. An X is marked on the grave headstone, is marked on the headstone as well, meaning that he was executed by the state of Texas. How weird is that? I thought that was really weird.
That was odd, but That makes sense.
Right. And finally, his death row number, which was 999055, which I thought was weird because if you take those nines and flip them upside down, that'd be 666. Just saying.
Well, yeah, it's true. He's a pretty evil man.
His last meal, according to death row chef Brian Price, was a hamburger fashioned to resemble his request of a steak. According to the Texas, According to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice death row section, McDuff's final words were, quote, "I'm ready to be released. Release me," end quote.
Wow.
Now, I have a couple footnotes here for you, because, of course, this case caused, obviously, huge shockwaves in the criminal justice system, and it led to some really big changes in Texas. And I guess everywhere people had to reconsider what they did, you know, as far as the justice system. The Texas legislature passed
the justice system. Wait, how? Like for parole?
I'm gonna tell you, Jim.
Because I didn't know what you were talking about.
No, that was my lead-in.
Like death row.
Nope. So the Texas legislature passed sweeping reforms, and citizens overwhelmingly voted for a $1 billion bond to finance more prison beds. The result was dramatic and gives us what we tend to know or think about the crimes in Texas. And that is what, and this is what you said earlier, Texas executes more than any other state. They have pretty hard stance, but they weren't always, right? And courtesy of Kenneth McDuff, they do now. Other changes included minimum parole eligibility. So that doubled for violent offenders. They let him out. He killed three people and they let him go. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's a shocker.
Mm-hmm.
Prisons expanded from 38,000 beds to 140,000 beds. And good time was looked at. It was reformed in what they considered good time. And if you served your good time, you could be out earlier and all that stuff. So basically, it just became a lot stricter, I guess, in the state of Texas. And I would hope so after that catastrophe and after all the people that he killed. Now, looking at this, if these current reforms were present way back in 1966, when Kenneth McDuff was first sentenced to death, he, number one, most likely would have been executed because he was sitting on death row for the murder of those three teenagers. But let's say he did, by chance, happen to avoid execution for those deaths for whatever reasons. His life sentence for capital murder would have required him to serve at least 40 calendar years rather than the 10 years before the parole board would have even considered him. Because, you know, he got out in a short amount of time.
Exactly.
Also, when the parole board consideration came about, it would not have been the typical 3-member panel of the board as we see in the typical case, due to the extenuating circumstances and that he was serving a death sentence. The full 18-member parole board would have reviewed his case. And by doing that, they would have needed at least 12 votes saying yes to the parole versus, you know, having 3. Before they could vote, the board would have to have listened as well to any of the victims' loved ones who wanted to make a statement. And that would have to be taken into consideration before saying that he would be paroled. So in the end, this awful, awful case and how many poor people died, it did lead to some sweeping reforms in the justice system.
I don't know. I have a problem. I think if you're convicted on first-degree murder charges, I don't think you should get out. I don't think there should be a chance for parole.
He killed three teenagers.
I know.
But come on.
That's what I mean.
Like, even if you're not going to die, you need to, you've killed three people. Come on.
Right. No, I'm there. I'm with you on that.
I know. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jen, that's my case. That's the case. That's absolutely terrible, let me tell you.
It's horrible. And shame on Texas. At least they fixed it. If you commit a murder, first-degree murder, you shouldn't have a chance of parole. I'm sorry. You took somebody's life. Manslaughter? We can talk about something, you know.
Come on. Yeah, it's different that you were, and we've talked about this before, if you were maybe drunk driving and you killed somebody, which is heinous. I'm not saying it's not, but deliberately killing three people, three teenagers,
violently.
Right?
Yeah.
Violently. Yeah. It's terrible.
Yeah. I mean, can you really be reformed? I don't know. That's a whole different issue. And if you guys want to yell at me, it's ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com.
But Jen.
Unreal. Yeah.
So this was the ninth Nightmare Before Christmas. But let me add, just as I swear to goodness, I don't think we say this. I think we say this about every time with somebody that kills people. If they've killed nine people, you know they've killed more. So he has been suspected of killing as many as 14 people, but nine right. confirmed, right?
Unreal.
And he was very, like I said earlier, he was very hush-hush with saying where the bodies were, which is terrible. Like,
well, it's his little secret
power.
That he likes to keep, right?
Yep. It is power.
Mm-hmm.
Jerk. All right. So Merry Christmas
Horrible.
To you all.
Merry Christmas.
And,
Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
Nine Christmas. Down. More to go. Three, nine, 10, 11, 12. Three more to go.
Yeah, three more to go. Three more to grow, as Jen just said.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Jen, remember, especially after talking about murder for so many nights in a row, and I'm frankly a little tired of it.
We'll see you tomorrow.
I know, right? Remember, Jen, lock your doors.
Keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.
Today's episode was researched and written by me, Cam. For more information about this episode, as well as all the sources I used, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by hosts Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from October Pod VHS. Our True Crime Podcast is executive produced by Nico Vertese and Dick Vain. Make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter at Our True Crime Pod. You can email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. If you really like the show, make sure to check out our Patreon at Our True Crime Podcast. Our True Crime Podcast is an OTC production.